This is Dr. David Emanuel in his teaching on the Exodus Psalms. This is session number 2, Psalm 78, God Chose David.
Now, in this video, we move on from Psalm 136, which was the last in the Psalter of the Exodus Psalms. We're going to go back and try and follow the order of the Psalms by looking at Psalm 78, which I've entitled, And God Chose David. This is the Psalm 78. This is the second longest psalm in the Psalter. Many people know what the longest psalm in the Psalter is. You can identify that as 119. But not many people know what the second longest psalm is. And so you can, if anybody asks you that in a quiz, you can claim to know it. It's Psalm 78, which is dedicated to the Exodus motif, second longest. We saw that the Psalm 136 was set in the framework, in a liturgical framework that was meant to be recited together in some kind of ceremonial, some kind of festival. Here we find a psalm that is established in a wisdom framework, which is, we'll see as we look at the introduction, you'll see many words and a lot of wisdom vocabulary that certainly that brings us to think about literature such as the book of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. The psalmist here has sacrificed chronological order. Chronological order is something that we have baked into our minds as being the guiding force in the arrangement of biblical literature, of literature generally, but it's something that the ancients were certainly less concerned with. For them, it was more important to teach a point, to teach a message, to encourage people to good works, to know God. These are the aspects that they were more important with. And if that meant that they had to sacrifice chronological order, then so be it. They were happy to do that so long as people got the message of what they were trying to teach. And that's a very important principle we need to understand. It's an important principle which you need to keep at the forefront of your mind when you're reading biblical literature generally. Just because X comes after Y, it does not necessarily mean to say chronologically it occurred in that particular way. This psalm has a complex redactional history, which is to say that the psalm was, there are layers of this psalm, and that it was developed, and that the version that we have today was probably not the the first version that was originally written. Now, how you identify redactional layers in the psalm, that's not for this particular series of lectures, but this is something which has been identified by many scholars of it. For our purposes, what this means is that the psalm there are definitely two strata within it that kind of point towards two different messages, two different points to its composition. The first of them is learning from history. And so as we read the psalm, you will see a very strong movement towards teaching people how important it is to remember what your ancestors have done and not to repeat the same mistakes. And that is something we'll see as we go through the psalm. That's a prominent theme within it. The second one is the selection of David and Judah. And we find that at the end of the psalm. Now, as we will look at the structure of the psalm in just a moment, and you'll see how these two points are emphasized within the psalm itself. But the selection of David and Judah, basically the selection of the southern kingdom of Israel for the establishment of the temple and Jerusalem, the holy city, that is something as well which is taught, and the rejection of Ephraim, which is symbolic of the northern kingdom of Israel. So we see these two aspects within the psalm, and it kind of like obfuscates a lot of the narrative flow within it. But if you keep these two things in mind, you should be able to make some sense of it. So let's look at a brief look at the structure, very brief look at the structure, the importance, 1 to 8, the importance of recounting the deeds of the Lord, remembering the deeds of the Lord. That's something that is critical to the psalm, but more so to that first message, remembering what God has done for Israel, particularly his miracles. We then have Ephraim's unfaithfulness in 9 to 11. We'll talk about that a little bit more, because the notion of Ephraim switches a bit from the tribe to the northern kingdom, the northern tribes. Ephraim was very big and influential. There were many members of that tribe. And so oftentimes the northern kingdom of Israel was known and is referred to as Ephraim. Then we have a series of recitals about the faithlessness of Israel against the kindness of God. And that's a series of different incidents from history and from the Exodus in which this is drilled through. God is kind by doing things. Israel responds by rebelling. God is kind in not punishing them to the extent, but he does punish them. But then he's merciful to them. He's kind to them, and they rebel against him. And that that's a recital, and that idea or that pattern goes throughout that particular recital. Then we have a psalmist summary, 34 to 41, approximately, where the psalmist basically emphasizes the point. It's not enough just to mention examples. It's always important as well to specify in explicit words what your point is. And that's what's going on here. And we see this idea in parables. When Jesus tells a parable, he won't just mention the parable, but frequently he will say, so don't be like this, so don't do that. So you give the example, but then you make sure to be explicit, that you're explicit, and say exactly what your point is. We then have a second recital of faithfulness in light of God's kindness, and here we go down to the plagues. A lot of it is down to the plagues and the initial entry into Israel. And this second recital kind of parallels the first one here. And you'll notice as well that because the plagues are mentioned in this recital here, the plagues, well, that occurred before the splitting of the sea in the wilderness tradition. And so for the psalmist, this example here, even though it's chronologically before this one, he places it. He reverses the order, and it's not a problem, because this is the point that he wants to emphasize. That's the direction in which he wants to go in right there. And then at the end, there's a conclusion, which is the rejection of Ephraim and Judah and David selected. Judah as God's shepherd for Israel, taking over from God's responsibilities. Now, in this psalm, in this structure, it's worth noting a couple of things. One of them is this central position here. And we'll see that it's bracketed by the two recitals. And then it's bracketed again by the mention of Ephraim. And I can draw this out, this kind of a... it's called chiastic, but strictly speaking, it's not exactly that. But we see, and we'll see this elsewhere as well. So we'll see in this particular case, you'll see an A, B, you'll have X, and then you'll have B, and then you'll have A here. And so you'll have these corresponding positions here, then these corresponding positions here, and this X is usually what we call an emphatic position, an emphatic location. It's a place where the heart of, or an important part of your message is saved, and it's reserved for that particular part of the psalm. And for us, it's the psalmist's summary of events of rebellion and constant sin, which we find here. So that's one thing we have to remember. The second, or another very important emphatic position within a psalm, comes at the end. Frequently psalmists, and not just psalmists, we find this in biblical prose as well, when they want to make a very important point, they leave it until the end. So when you finish reading that composition, that is the flavor you're left with. And so they want to make it emphatic. They want to make it very strong. So you are leaving with the important message that they seek to portray. Good. So let's look at some individual parts. We're not going to be able to look at all of it. It's a very long psalm. Time is limited. So I want to take from certain sections. I want to look at some of some interesting points within the psalm itself. We begin here with this expression, listen to my instruction. And this is one of the phrases that we have, which links to the idea, not phrases, let's say, it's one of the interpretations that we have that links with the notion of wisdom. Listen to my instruction, which occurs in the first verse. I'm sorry, I haven't actually put it up there. The word for instruction in this particular location is the Hebrew word Torah. We find this in verse 1, which I said I hadn't actually mentioned there. But Torah is the word for instruction. Now, this is most people, when you ask them, what does the word Torah mean? The first thing they say is it means law. But that's not the way we should be translating it all of the time. And oftentimes in wisdom literature, we find that the word Torah is translated as instruction. And that's probably a better meaning than what we have in Torah. It's about guiding, it's about leading, it's about instructing someone in the way in which they could go. So that's the first hint we find of wisdom literature in this particular psalm. But we find other examples as well. I'd mentioned before, how do I identify wisdom literature? By the vocabulary. We have these phrases and expressions. We have the psalm, the initial psalm, it's called a maskil. A maskil is from a root, sachal, sechel, sin, kaf, lamid. That's the root, which means wisdom, understanding, intelligence. It has those types of meaning to it. Whoops, let me just change that. That's shechal, and I mean sechal. It's a sin. Sorry about that. So that's very much a word that implies wisdom. But we also have these expressions to the words of my mouth, found in Proverbs 4:5 and 5:7. That's an expression frequently used in Proverbs. We find the word proverb, mashal, in verse 2. I'm sorry I don't have that up here now, but it's another word which is frequently used in wisdom literature. Mashal, a short saying, an aphorism that teaches the reader. And we also have this word, chida, which is a riddle. It's that's one way of understanding it. But once we go into the world of poetry, we enter into the world of poetry, we have to always be very careful with applying meanings of words, because oftentimes you will simply have, if a psalmist, let's say, uses the word proverb in one part, in one half, in a colon, In order to balance that, he needs another word that has a similar meaning, so he might choose the word chida. And it doesn't necessarily mean to say that we have to understand the pure meanings. It just means to say that these two are related words, and he's using one to balance the other one out. And that occurs in biblical parallelism. And again, this is not a course on Hebrew poetry, so I won't go into too much detail, but it's something that you need to be aware of. We have over here repetition, which occurs, and that's what I wanted to show you in this particular slide. We see the idea of telling and instruction repeated in various ways. We have our fathers have told us, it says there, to teach them and to tell them. And that is repeated throughout the psalm. And we also have the idea of children, 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 four times. Just in these verses here, I've got verses from 3 to 7. So in this small section, relatively short section, we have this emphasis on teaching children. Teaching children. And it's something, as we read Psalms generally, we need to be very, very cognizant of. If we see ideas repeated, then it means that the psalmist is insisting that we listen to this particular thing, that it's an important point in the whole of his creation. So we have that repetition, and we also have this word, niflaot, in verse 4. Praise the Lord, the strength and his wondrous works. That's how it's translated here, but that is the Hebrew again, niflaot, back to that word pele, which we saw in Psalm 136. Which basically means that it's a deed, a work that is greater than man could actually do. It's miracle terminology. And I'll say even further that oftentimes when we find the word in this particular format, which is a nifal participle, it means specifically the Exodus. The miracles wrought at the Exodus, whether it was the plagues, whether it was the splitting of the sea, whether it was the provision of food. All of these are counted as niflaot, things which are too great for man to do. We then have next section, a very peculiar section, very peculiar content, which deals with Ephraim's unfaithfulness. And the text seems to be speaking of a mysterious event that we don't know much about. The sons of Ephraim, at some stage, we have nothing in the Bible that specifically speaks of this. They turn back in a day of battle. They retreat in a day of battle, and in connection with a refusal to obey or to follow the laws of God. We do not have any evidence of this in the Bible at all. So we have to begin to ask the question, well, where does it come from? It's unlikely that he's just made this stuff up to fit in his psalm. He's trying to create a work that's going to have appeal or are going to have a degree of understanding to his contemporaries. So it has to be something that they know about and he knows about, that he could therefore reference. So the likelihood is that there is a high likelihood that he's dealing with an ancient tradition that we do not have recorded in Scripture. And let me just take some time to explain that notion. We know that the Bible has been written and obviously covers a historical period, a huge historical period, a couple thousand years. And it's often thought, or it's easy to think, that within the Bible we have all of the historical traditions captured and nothing else was going on around it. But that's not the case. There were many other traditions around the Bible, some of them paralleling the events that we have recorded, that's very similar but not exactly the same. There were many of these things around that everybody knew about. And oftentimes, psalmists, poets, but also other biblical writers would draw upon some of these traditions. Now, they never knew that they would; these other traditions were not going to be crystallized in Holy Writ, but they were able to draw and touch upon some of these other traditions. And we have that, if you think of the New Testament, we have that in the Gospel of Thomas, which is not in our Bibles, but it was another gospel that was written that people would have known about in the Gospel of Judas, and we have these things around. So it's not a totally unfamiliar idea. So in this case here, it would appear as though many people think that there is a tradition involving Ephraim, which is not in the Bible. Now, in order to find out or to dig up where these other traditions might appear, a nice place to go is the Targums. The Targums, the early rabbinic writings, the early Jewish literature as well from the Second Temple period. These are the places we need to go to see if we find echoes of it. And in Targum Psalms, we find this mentioned here. While they were living in Egypt, this is the Israelites, whilst they were in Egypt, the sons of Ephraim became arrogant. They calculated the appointed time and erred. They made a mistake. They went out 30 years before the appointed time, that's before Moses led them, with weapons of war and warriors bearing bows. They turned around and were killed on the day of battle. And so we have an echo. Now, there's always the very big question concerning is the author of Targum Psalms, is he reflecting the same tradition that is recorded here in Psalm 78, or is he creating his own midrash? He sees that this is not in the Bible, and so he generates this story as well. Now, that's a big question. We can't be 100% certain, but I do want us to be aware of the possibility of another tradition echoed in this psalm, because later on in the psalm, we may see signs of another tradition too. So we have to be aware of it. There are two possibilities that we just need to be cognizant of as we go through the psalm. As mentioned here, other instances, I think there are other instances of traditions which seem to be seeping into the psalm, which are not recorded explicitly in biblical literature. So look at the first recital. That begins with the sea splitting, and it speaks of he divided the sea, he made the waters stand up like a heap, and this is simply wording that echoes Exodus 15:8. We know that Exodus 15, the song of the sea, was highly influential in poetic renditions of the Exodus, and it seems as though, rather than the prose tradition, that the psalmist has used or adopted the poetic tradition from Exodus rather than the prose. Throughout this psalm, you'll see as well, the emphasis is very much on miracles, on magnificent works that God actually does that are really, really impressive. And these are the things, it's as though God is working overtime for the sake of the Israelites in order to really encourage them to be to respond correctly to the things he is asking of them. What of Pharaoh? We don't hear about Pharaoh in this particular psalm. He goes back to the Exodus. Remember in Psalm 136, Pharaoh was destroyed. He's mentioned it. God is portrayed as this warrior, this king type figure. But here, it's the miracle. It's the magnificent work of God that's being emphasized. And so we don't hear about Pharaoh. We don't hear about his destruction of his army into the sea, because it's about the miracle. It's about the miraculous power of the God of Israel. We move on to the provision of bread. And we see again this idea, another idea of the doors of heaven. It's an example of God's response, his merciful response to disobedience. I mean, prior to this, in verses 17 to 20, the psalmist says that they sinned against God testing him in their hearts. So even though they have this sinful response to his miracle, God is still merciful. And he wants to provide them with bread. And we have this, this is obviously a rendition of the manna tradition. There's one in Numbers 11, and there's another in Exodus 16, which speaks of God providing a miraculous provision of bread. But the rendition, I would argue, in this poetic case, is far more, I wouldn't say exaggerated, but it's more miraculous. It's more exaggerated. He rained down manna upon them to eat and gave them food. And when you read that, it's as though they're walking and this manna is falling down from the sky. That's the way he's portrayed it. But when we look at the story in Exodus, it's much more basic. They would kind of, a mist would rise and there's this kind of stuff on the ground that they had to pick up and do various things with. So the way in which it occurs is really quite different. So we've got the power, the magnificence of God is being emphasized in all of this. Here as well, we see this idea, where is it? He did not trust in God, he rained down, he opened the doors of heaven. We've got this idea of the doors of heaven being opened. And I just want to say a couple words about this. There is an idea in biblical literature that up in heaven, the perception of the world was not quite as we would have it. But up in the firmament, if I draw this out, the perception of the world was such that there were rivers here and mountains, and this is the world, and there's land here. But there was a perception that up in the sky there was something firm. There was something hard and concrete, which is called, in Hebrew it's called the rakia, which is, in English they call it the firmament. And it was a solid thing here, which occasionally it would open up. It would open up briefly and rain would come down from it and then God would shut it down again. That's the way in which they perceived the ancient world. And in addition to that, there was also the idea that up here, so if we go back here, there were various storehouses. So there were storehouses for wind, there were storehouses for rain, and in addition to that, there was a storehouse for other things, for provisions that God wanted to provide people. So there was the idea of the doors of heaven being open to provide things, the windows in heaven. And we see this idea echoed in 2 Kings 7:2. Behold, if the Lord should make windows in heaven, could this thing be? And this was regard to a famine in the days of Elisha. So they had an idea that in heaven there could have been windows that would open up and just pour down all of these supplies. And we see it in Malachi as well. And test me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven. And so we've got this idea of heavenly windows opening up and food just coming down. And those notions, which the psalmist obviously would have known about, we see being applied in this particular situation with the Israelites. Something else concerning this food is the manna, which is described in a very a relatively peculiar way. I'd mentioned before in the book of Numbers, manna, well, it's a type of natural seed. It's a residue. It's something that comes on the ground. It's something that is, plausible, something that we can easily understand. You pick up from the ground and you bake it, you crush it, you roast it, you do whatever you want with it. That's the way in which it's perceived in Numbers. For the psalmist, it becomes more than this. It becomes almost a divine food. And it is described as food, divine food, the bread of angels. He sent them food from heaven, the bread of angels. And here there's the notion, or there's at least hints of a tradition, that what's being eaten is the same food that angels eat. So there's a suggestion, there is a tradition out there that in heaven they eat food, and it's from this supply, this heavenly food, that we then find God giving to man. And this idea of angels' food being given to man, it's an idea, we see it again, Targum Psalms mentions, hints at it as well. The sons of men ate food that came down from the abode of angels. He sent them provisions unto satiety. We see this idea here, but we also see same idea with Elijah. When Elijah is fleeing from Jezebel, he runs in the desert and he throws himself under a broom tree and says, let me die, Lord, let me die. And then he is woken up and an angel comes and gives him this with bread. And he takes this bread and he eats this bread, and it sustains him all the way to Mount Sinai. So this idea of angels' food coming to men, it seems to be an idea, a notion, a tradition that was out there during the days of the psalmist, and it's being tapped into right here at this particular point. The provision of meat, which comes afterwards, it seems more in keeping with the tradition in Numbers. We have both of them mention the wind, an east wind here, which is modified with the direction from which it comes. But we have the idea of a wind bringing the quail at this particular time as well. So in this case, there isn't a whole load of similar wording between the two, but the allusion is quite clear as to where he's coming from. But we also see an omission, because we have all of these cases, we have the provision of food, but the law giving at Sinai is not mentioned, neither is the rebellion of Miriam and Aaron against Moses. None of these find any kind of a mention. They're not part of the psalmist's plan. For the psalmist, his main enemy, or the main conflict, occurs between the nation of Israel on the whole, or even the tribe of Israel, and God himself. So this is one psalm where God's enemy is more aptly described as the people, the nation of Israel, as opposed to any other people or nation. The psalmist summary, I mentioned this before, it occupies this central position, which was very important. It's an emphatic location, and so he basically speaks out or summarizes the behavior of the Israelites, making statements such as God was gracious, Israel ignored him and rebelled against him. They paid him lip service. They faked repentance towards him. And most importantly, they forgot his miracles. That's what they did. And if we go back to the beginning and that emphasize of telling and of sons, we see that forgetting his miracles is a sure way to walk into his punishment and his judgments. So all of this is done, central position again, as a warning to future generations. From there, we go into the second recital, and here it's mainly taken up with the plagues. Now, up here, I've got a list of the plagues as they appear in Exodus and as they appear in the psalm, the orders. And you will see that there is a difference. Lots of the plagues are the same, but the order is different, and the number of psalms is different as well. We'll be addressing that in just a moment. But let's take a brief look at the plagues first of all. We have blood, which is in the first place. Both plagues traditions begin with that, with God striking the water. He strikes the water and it becomes fills with blood. The water becomes undrinkable. Then we have the plague of swarms. Now, I'm specifically saying swarms, which comes, you'll notice as well, before frogs. You've got blood, swarms over here, and swarms is down here. And I'm going to, I have to qualify that by saying swarms of what? Now, in the Hebrew Bible, as many people are familiar with, the plague being referred to here is in fact, or usually called, flies. The plague of flies. The Hebrew word, though, is in fact arov, which literally means swarms. It is undefined. It does not have to necessarily mean flies. And the reason why we find flies in most of the English translations of the Bible is because they take their interpretation from the Septuagint, which reads dog fly. And so that's why we see it there. But it's very important to remember that the swarms are, the idea of swarming is undefined. What is interesting here is that these swarms in the Psalms, they have the power to devour. They have the power to eat, and they have the power to consume, which begins to suggest that it may not be flies that he's actually talking about. It may be, but it may not actually be flies he is actually talking about. When we go to a different tradition of this, in the Targums, when it talks about the plague of Arov, this is what it says. I will stir up upon thee, among thee, and thy servants and thy people, and thy house, a mixed multitude of wild beasts. And the houses of Mitzri, which is Egypt, shall be filled with a swarm of wild beasts. And they shall be on the land also. So here in this Jewish tradition in the Targums, the swarms are not flies, but the swarms are wild animals. A swarm of wild animals taking over the land. And this kind of seems more in keeping with the idea of devouring, because if you have wild lions, wolves, and everything else, then they are more likely to perform an action like devouring. So that could be one way of explaining it. And this tradition as well, it's worth mentioning, is the tradition or the understanding of Arov, which we find in contemporary Jewish literature as well. So I was actually dismayed to see this when I was looking at, but the first time my daughter was in grade school, she came back during Passover, and when it came to the plague of what I knew was flies, it was a group of wild animals. And it's because that's the interpretation which they had, which differed so much from the Christian tradition. The next plague is that of frogs, which in Exodus are a nuisance, but here we've got frogs which destroyed them. So they cause some type of damage. Now, what kind of frogs were they? Very difficult to know what's going on, but you kind of wonder as well if there is a bit of thinking of Revelation in this. Because if we look at the book of Revelation, I said before that it's the Exodus motif is everywhere. But in the book of Revelation, we find animals with, weird locusts with huge teeth that devour people and cause people a great deal of suffering. So we may find this type of hyperbole in the description of the plagues and the damage which they do. So that's potential for frogs, which we have there. We then have the plague of locust, which is here in the Psalm number 8. Again, difference in order, and it comes directly from God. He sends them. This introduces an idea that we see in the Exodus Psalms quite a lot. The role of men is frequently pushed down and the role of God is elevated. He is the one that directly performs a lot of the plagues and the miracles, and we see much less of Moses and Aaron. There's a degree of repetition here in this particular psalm. We have locusts and young locusts. And I'd mentioned before, we can't make too much of this, but in biblical parallelism, we have to have word pairs that balance each other out. And so we have that in this particular case. Then we have the plague of hail, in which two verses are dedicated to it, and it affects both plants and animals. And you'll see why that's significant in just a moment. And at this particular point, we've got with the plague of hails in verse 47, he destroyed with hailstones their vines and their sycamore trees with frost. And this is another one of those emphatic patterns, a chiastic pattern. I go to the board again just to schematize it. And it's basically normal Hebrew parallelism would look like this. A, B, a parallel A, and then a parallel B like this, where these two words would be would correspond. They would have the same semantic plane. So you'd use, in this case, locust and young locust in the B portion of it. But what's happening here in this verse is we move to an emphatic form in which we have an A and a B, and then it's switched around, and then we have a B corresponding and an A. And this is something which is called a chiasm, chiasmus. I don't know how different people refer to it differently, but it's an emphatic structure. And we see it not just used here, it's used in a number of other places, but I would argue, and I am arguing in another paper which I'm writing, that this is a very much an important controlling structure in the psalm, in the whole of the psalm itself. Good. Moving on, we have this phrase that comes on, an insert. So he kind of devotes a verse for each plague, then he doubles it, and then he speaks about God's burning anger. He's not talking about a plague, but he's building up to the last plague. And he speaks of a band of destroying angels. He leveled a path for his anger. He didn't spare their soul from death, gave over their life to the plague. That's what he does here. And this is pestilence. This is the plague of pestilence right here. And so, but there's an added build up towards it, a dramatic build up for emphasis. And we have something else as well, which is another poetic form, which is called delayed identification. And what's happening is what the psalmist would describe and talk about something and not mention it specifically until the last word or at the very end of the sentence, the verse, or the actual section. So he would build up and he will talk about it and then he will mention it finally, be explicit about it. It's called delayed identification, can create a degree of emphasis. We'll see another example of it. And in this case here, it's the whole description of him becoming angry, destroying angels. But the plague itself, he's emphasizing this doesn't come until last. It's only mentioned finally. Men seem to be affected in this plague of pestilence, although in Exodus it's more of a cattle plague and on the beasts. But this seems to be, so this seems to be slightly different. Looking at the plagues here as well, darkness is not included, boils are not included, and neither are lice. So we've got the plague of the firstborn has the ultimate position in both of these renditions. So he has maintained something of the what we know as the original, though whether it is or not is a different story. Some general comments on the plague. One is we notice a 7-plague tradition in Exodus versus a 10-plague tradition in the book of Exodus. 7 in the Psalms, 10 in Exodus. The two numbers 7 and 10 are, I want to say, basically the same, because they're both numbers that represent completeness. And if you look at these two examples of how they're used, there was a popular expression amongst the Israelites which uses this number. One of them, one instance of that expression occurs here in 1 Samuel, where Elkanah says to her husband, her husband said to Hannah, this is the mother of Samuel, "Why do you weep and why do you not eat? Why is your heart sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons?" So it's a complete number. "I'm not better to you than 10 sons." But we find in Ruth, we've got the similar or the same expression, "who loves you is better to you than 7 sons." So we've got the idea of completeness expressed in 10 in one case and 7 in another. So it's not really a huge surprise that in one tradition it's 7 and in the other it's 10. They are both numbers that represent and express the same thing. Is there a question of increasing severity? Possibly. Certain scholars have argued for this. It's very general to see. It's not that explicit, moving from the blood in the waters, which doesn't actually kill anybody, it just causes more of a discomfort, to the swarms, but they then begin devouring people, so it's harder to argue here. Certainly once we get to the idea of pestilence, the build-up is greater, and we have God speaking about his anger and his band of angels he's going to send out against them, and then we come to the plague of the firstborn, which is definitely the most severe plague suffered. So there's, some would argue that there is a question of increasing severity. But when we look at Psalm 105, we'll see, I think there's a clearer picture of that possibility. And something else we need to bear in mind is Moses and Aaron do not appear in any of these renditions of the psalm. When we're talking about poetry in most of the renditions of the plagues, it is God who does it directly. The heroic deeds are performed by God, and for the most part, men only sin against God, rebel, and complain. And that's a pattern that we see expressed in most of the Psalms in different ways. After that, we find God leading, God as shepherd. This is very important for the remainder of the Psalm. He led them forth. He led them safely. He brought them to his holy land. So God is Israel's shepherd as he takes them through the desert, out of Egypt and through the desert. And that's important to remember. And it's probably for this reason that we find the change in order. Because we've already seen the desert events, but now he's focusing on this aspect of God leading Israel. He is their shepherd. It's basically a summary of the wilderness activity, but the details were given earlier, all of the sin, all of the testing of God for bread and for other things. After this, we have rebellion and punishment, whereby the Israelites, once they enter into the promised land, they didn't learn anything from the desert, and they rebel against God, and so he punishes them. They continue to test God once they get into the land. And these are general references to the high places and the idols. And the high places were hills upon which altars were built and which people worshipped God as well as the God of Israel. They would worship other idols and other deities as well. As a result of this, God kind of abandons his people, and the psalm makes a reference to the destruction at Shiloh. And this is probably an allusion to 1 Samuel 4, in which the Israelites went out to war with the Ark of the Covenant. They were defeated by the Philistines, and the Philistines stole the Ark. They took it away. And this is probably a reference here. He gave up his strength to captivity. And the word here is oz, which in other contexts is a direct reference to the Ark of the Covenant. So that's probably the allusion that we've got here. And more so here, you've got his priests fell by the sword. And this is probably an allusion to Hophni and Phinehas are dead. So those were two of the high priest's sons, Eli's sons, who went out to war, and they are killed. So we've got priests falling by the sword right here. Probably that's in all likelihood, that's the reference being made. So you've got the priests, Hophni and Phinehas, dying. But then you've also got another reference being made to his widows could not weep. And in this particular place, after our dead person there, we've got the instance of Phinehas's wife who was unable to mourn because as she was giving birth, she died after she gave birth. So she wasn't even able to mourn because she died and she gave birth early as a result of finding out the ark was taken, her husband was dead, Eli was dead, and all of these things had happened. So she died and was not able to mourn. And his widows could not weep. So this is probably a reference to this whole incident right here. Then we have something, God gives up his people. Then we have something which is very rather daring imagery. It says, then the Lord awoke as if from sleep. And so the question is, not just sleeping, but it's overcome by wine. So the picture here very much is of somebody who's not just in a deep sleep, but somebody who's in a drunken stupor, that he is totally out through alcohol. And as a result, it seems like this, that God is not doing anything. But as we know from scripture, as we know in certain places, God does not sleep. Psalm 121:4 says, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber or sleep. That's an image which we have, which is later. But certainly before that, in the days of the monarchy, the early monarchy, there was a notion that of the sleeping deity. There was a notion that God, it would seem at least to the people, that he did sleep. And so we have passages where Isaiah says, awake, awake. Put on strength, O arm of the Lord. He's saying, he's actually kind of telling God, wake up, as in the days of old, and do something. And we see here as well in Psalm 44, a clear example. Arouse yourself. Why do you sleep, O Lord? Do not reject us forever. So it's a perception that we have, or perception that's created, that God is asleep, and that he needs to be stirred through prayers and intercession and shouting and whatever it is, into action once again. And that's the image that we have here, that of the sleeping deity who awakes and then he becomes to the rescue of his people, Israel. Here we've got our climactic ending, in which I'd said, we'd mentioned the first important part of passing information down, and now we come to the second part. The second important part, which is the rejection of Ephraim. Ephraim's rejected. The northern kingdom and the people of the north are not selected for the housing of God's holy city and the holy tabernacle as well. So Ephraim is rejected. Instead, Judah is chosen for the temple. The tribe is the location approximately of Judah, where the temple was actually built up in Jerusalem. And more importantly than that, David is selected as God's leader, if you like. And the important thing here to remember is that throughout the psalm, it is conspicuous the omission of any individuals named. We don't have Moses, we don't have Aaron, we don't really have, I forget about Pharaoh. Names aren't mentioned. And so when all of a sudden we see here the name David, it's a big deal, because now the psalmist is revealing the importance of this particular individual. And more than just his revealing him, if you remember a few slides back, we saw God, was leading Israel, guiding them as their shepherd. But now it's like God takes the reins of leading and guiding Israel and he hands them over to David. And it says here, he brought him to shepherd Jacob. So he shepherded them and he guided them. And all of this is language of leading and guidance, which was once belonging to God, but now it goes down to David and it's his responsibility to be God's man. With that said, let's just summarize before we to close up this psalm with a few points. First of all, Psalm 78, it's long. I know I haven't done it justice. It would take a few more weeks to do that. But it focuses on God's miracles for Israel. Less on people, but more on the miraculous power of God. And it also focuses on the rebellion of Israel. In light of his goodness, in light of his going above and beyond to help them out, they rebel against him. They don't act appropriately to what his great power deserves. And then the other emphasis also was learning from the past. And in this sense, as I said before, it was connected with wisdom traditions that you would learn from it. Some omissions, the giving of Torah, not mentioned again. Not sure why. It would seem as though there would be a good instance to talk about the rebellion, because whilst they were waiting for Moses to come down the mountain, they get Aaron to create this golden calf. But that's not mentioned. We also have the word Torah mentioned in the psalm, but it's the incident of the giving of the Torah. The law giving is not specified. An individual rebellion, so the rebellions of Dathan and Abiram, these are not mentioned either. It's mainly the Ephraimites and the Israelites who do battle with God and become his enemy. Something else I would mention too is the hints of lost traditions, the bread of angels and the Ephraimites' retreat when they pulled back in battle. We don't have clear evidence of that in biblical literature, so it seems as though, and in my view at least, the fact that we have these other traditions kind of hints towards the earliness of this particular psalm. I don't want to get into dating in this case because there's a lot of controversy about it, but I think it kind of hints to the earliness, the early nature, the early feel of this particular psalm. And then we have the elevation of God. Moses and Aaron absent. God does everything directly. He splits the sea. It's God who provides the bread. It's God who provides the quail. He does all of these. He sends the plague and there's no sign of God. So we have the elevation of God. And the other thing, as I'd mentioned before, only David is named. And in all of the Exodus tradition, if you think about it, which what the psalm so much focuses on, speaking about the Exodus, there's nothing mentioned of Moses, nothing mentioned of Aaron, but David is recalled. And that should again really emphasize the central point of this psalm. So that's Psalm 78, the longest psalm that we have in the Bible dedicated to the Exodus tradition.
This is Dr. David Emmanuel in his teaching on the Exodus Psalms. This is session number 2, Psalm 78, God Chose David.